smile. It's fun to speculate. As Charles Darwin said in his Descent of Man, false facts are highly injurious to the progress of science, for they often endure long, but false views, if supported by some evidence, do little harm, for everyone takes a salutary pleasure in proving their falseness, and when this is done, one path toward errors is closed, and the road to truth is often at the same time opened. Chapter 9. An Ape with a Soul. How Introspection Evolved. Hang up philosophy, unless philosophy can make a Juliet. William Shakespeare. Jason Murdoch was an inpatient at a rehabilitation center in San Diego. After a serious head injury in a car accident near the Mexican border, he had been in a semi-conscious state of vigilant coma, also called akinetic mutism, for nearly 3 months before my colleague, Dr. Subramaniam Sriram, examined him. Because of damage to the anterior cingulate cortex in the front of his brain, Jason couldn't walk, talk, or initiate actions. His sleep-wake cycle was normal, but he was bedridden. When awake, he seemed alert and conscious. If that's the right word, words lose their resolving power when dealing with such states. He sometimes had slight ouch withdrawal in response to pain, but not consistently. He could move his eyes, often swiveling them around to follow people. Yet he couldn't recognize anyone, not even his parents or siblings. He could not talk or comprehend speech, nor could he interact with people meaningfully. But if his father, Mr. Murdoch, phoned him from next door, Jason suddenly became alert and talkative, recognizing his dad and engaging him in conversation. That is, until Mr. Murdoch went back into the room. Then Jason lapsed back into his semi-conscious zombie state. Jason's cluster of symptoms has a name, telephone syndrome. He could be made to flip back and forth between the two states, depending on whether his father was directly in his presence or not. Think of what this means. It is almost as if there are two Jasons trapped inside one body, the Jason on the phone, who is fully alert and conscious, and the Jason in person, who is a barely conscious zombie. How can this be? The answer has to do with how the accident affected the visual and auditory pathways in Jason's brain. To a surprising extent, the activity of each pathway, vision and hearing, must be segregated all the way up to the critically important anterior cingulate. This collar of tissue, as we shall see, is where your sense of free will partly originates. If the anterior cingulate is extensively damaged, the result is the full picture of akinetic mutism. Unlike Jason, the patient is in a permanent twilight state, not interacting with anyone under any circumstances. But what if the damage to the anterior cingulate is more subtle? Say, the visual pathway to the anterior cingulate is damaged selectively at some stage, but the auditory pathway is fine. The result is telephone syndrome. Jason springs to action, speaking metaphorically, when chatting on the phone, but lapses into akinetic mutism when his father walks into the room. Except when he is on the telephone, Jason is no longer a person. I am not making this distinction arbitrarily. Although Jason's visuomotor system can still track and automatically attend to objects in space, he cannot recognize or attribute meaning to what he sees. Except when he is on the phone with his father, Jason lacks the ability to form rich, meaningful meta-representations, which are essential to not only our uniqueness as a species, but also our uniqueness as individuals and our sense of self. Why is Jason a person when he is on the phone, but not otherwise? Very early in evolution, the brain developed the ability to create first-order sensory representations of external objects that could elicit only a very limited number of reactions. For example, a rat's brain has only a first-order representation of a cat, specifically as a furry moving thing to avoid reflexively. But as the human brain evolved further, there emerged a second brain, a set of nerve connections, to be exact, that was in a sense parasitic on the old one. This second brain creates meta-representations, representations of representations, a higher order of abstraction, by processing the information from the first brain into manageable chunks that can be used for a wider repertoire of more sophisticated responses, including language and symbolic thought. That is why, instead of just the furry enemy that it is for the rat, the cat appears to you as a mammal, a predator, a pet, an enemy of dogs and rats, a thing that has ears, whiskers, a long tail, and a meow. It even reminds you of Halle Berry in a latex suit. It also has a name, Cat, symbolizing the whole cloud of associations. In short, the second brain imbues an object with meaning, creating a meta-representation that allows you to be consciously aware of a cat in a way that the rat isn't. Meta-representations are also a prerequisite for our values, beliefs, and priorities. For example, a first-order representation of disgust is a visceral, avoid-it reaction, while a meta-representation would include, among other things, the social disgust you feel toward something you consider morally wrong or ethically inappropriate. Such higher-order representations can be juggled around in your mind in a manner that is unique to humans. They are linked to our sense of self and enable us to find meaning in the outside world, both material and social, and allow us to define ourselves in relation to it. For example, I can say, "I find her attitude toward emptying the cat litter box disgusting." The visual Jason is essentially dead and gone as a person because his ability to have meta-representations of what he sees is compromised. But the auditory Jason lives on. His meta-representations of his father, his self, and their life together are largely intact as activated via the auditory channels of his brain. Intriguingly, the hearing Jason is temporarily switched off when Mr. Murdoch appears in person to talk to his son. Perhaps because the human brain emphasizes visual processing, the visual Jason stifles his auditory twin. Jason presents a striking case of a fragmented self. Some of the pieces of Jason have been destroyed, yet others have been preserved and retain a surprising degree of functionality. Is Jason still Jason, if he can be broken into fragments? As we shall see, a variety of neurological conditions show us that the self is not the monolithic entity it believes itself to be. This conclusion flies directly in the face of some of our most deep-seated intuitions about ourselves, but data are data. What the neurology tells us is that the self consists of many components, and the notion of one unitary self may well be an illusion. Sometime in the 21st century, science will confront one of its last great mysteries, the nature of the self. That lump of flesh in your cranial vault not only generates an objective account of the outside world, but also directly experiences an internal world, a rich mental life of sensations, meanings, and feelings. Most mysteriously, your brain also turns its view back on itself to generate your sense of self-awareness. The search for the self and the solutions to its many mysteries is hardly a new pursuit. This area of study has traditionally been the preserve of philosophers, and it is fair to say that, on the whole, they haven't made a lot of progress, though not for want of effort. They have been at it for 2,000 years. Nonetheless, philosophy has been extremely useful in maintaining semantic hygiene and emphasizing the need for clarity in terminology. For example, people often use the word consciousness loosely to refer to two different things. One is qualia, the immediate experiential qualities of sensation, such as the redness of red or the pungency of curry, and the second is the self who experiences these sensations. Qualia are vexing to philosophers and scientists alike, because even though they are palpably real and seem to lie at the very core of mental experience, physical and computational theories about brain function are utterly silent on the question of how they might arise or why they might exist. Let me illustrate the problem with a thought experiment. Imagine an intellectually highly advanced but colorblind Martian scientist who sets out to understand what humans mean when they talk about color. With his Star Trek-level technology, he studies your brain and completely figures out, down to every last detail, what happens when you have mental experiences involving the color red. At the end of his study, he can account for every physiochemical and neurocomputational event that occurs when you see red, think of red, or say red. Now ask yourself, does this account encompass everything there is to the ability to see and think about redness? Can the colorblind Martian now rest assured that he understands your alien mode of visual experience, even though his brain is not wired to respond to that particular wavelength of electromagnetic radiation? Most people would say no. Most would say that no matter how detailed and accurate this outside objective description of color cognition might be, it has a gaping hole at its center because it leaves out the quali of redness. Quali is the singular form of qualia. Indeed, there is no way you can convey the ineffable quality of redness to someone else short of hooking up your brain directly to that person's brain. Perhaps science will eventually stumble on some unexpected method or framework for dealing with qualia empirically and rationally, but such advances could easily be as remote from our present-day grasp as molecular genetics was to those living in the Middle Ages, unless there is a potential Einstein of neurology lurking around somewhere. I suggested that qualia and self are different, yet you can't solve the former without the latter. The notion of qualia without a self experiencing, introspecting on them is an oxymoron. In similar vein, Freud had argued that we cannot equate the self with consciousness. Our mental life, he said, is governed by the unconscious, a roiling cauldron of memories, associations, reflexes, motives, and drives. Your conscious life is an elaborate, after-the-fact rationalization of things you really do for other reasons. Because technology had not yet advanced sufficiently to allow observation of the brain, Freud lacked the tools to take his ideas beyond the couch, and so his theories were caught in the doldrums between true science and untethered rhetoric. Might Freud have been right? Could most of what constitutes our self be unconscious, uncontrollable, and unknowable? Despite Freud's current unpopularity, to put it mildly, modern neuroscience has, in fact, revealed that he was right in arguing that only a limited part of the brain is conscious. The conscious self is not some sort of kernel or concentrated essence that inhabits a special throne at the center of the neural labyrinth, but neither is it a property of the whole brain. Instead, the self seems to emerge from a relatively small cluster of brain areas that are linked into an amazingly powerful network. Identifying these regions is important since it helps narrow the search. We know, after all, that the liver and the spleen are not conscious, only the brain is. We are simply taking a step further and saying that only some parts of the brain are conscious. Knowing which parts are and what they are doing is the first step toward understanding consciousness. The phenomenon of blindsight is a particularly clear indicator that there may be a grain of truth in Freud's theory of the unconscious. Recall from Chapter 2 that someone with blindsight has damage to the V1 area in the visual cortex and, as a result, cannot see anything. She is blind. She experiences none of the qualia associated with vision. If you project a spot of light on the wall in front of her, she will tell you categorically that she does not see anything. Yet if asked to reach out to touch the spot, she can do so with uncanny accuracy, even though to her it feels like a wild guess. She is able to do this, as we saw earlier, because the old pathway between her retina and her parietal lobe is intact. Even though she can't see the spot, she can still reach out and touch it. Indeed, a blindsight patient can often even guess the color and orientation of a line, vertical or horizontal, using this pathway, even though she cannot perceive it consciously. This is astonishing. It implies that only the information streaming through your visual cortex is associated with consciousness and linked to your sense of self. The other parallel pathway can go about its business performing the complex computations required for hand guidance, or even correctly guessing color, without consciousness ever coming into the picture. Why? These two paths for visual information are made up of identical-looking neurons, after all, and they seem to be performing equally complex computations, yet only the new pathway casts the light of consciousness on visual information. What's so special about these circuits that they require or generate consciousness? In other words, why aren't all aspects of vision and vision-guided behavior similar to blind sight, chugging along with competence and accuracy, but without conscious awareness and qualia? Might the answer to this question give clues to solving the riddle of consciousness? The example of blind sight is suggestive not only because it supports the idea of the unconscious mind, or several unconscious minds, it also demonstrates how neuroscience can marshal evidence about the innermost workings of the brain in order to make its way through the cold case file, so to speak, addressing some of the unanswered questions about the self that have plagued philosophers and scientists for millennia. By studying patients who have disturbances in self-representation and observing how specific brain areas malfunction, we can better understand how a sense of self arises in the normal human brain. Each disorder becomes a window on a specific aspect of the self. First, let's define these aspects of the self, or at the very least, our intuitions about them. 1. Unity. Despite the teeming diversity of sensory experiences that you are deluged with moment to moment, you feel like one person. Moreover, all of your various and sometimes contradictory goals, memories, emotions, actions, beliefs, and present awareness seem to cohere to form a single individual. 2. Continuity. Despite the enormous number of distinct events punctuating your life, you feel a sense of continuity of identity through time, moment to moment, decade to decade. And as Endel Tulving has noted, you can engage in mental time travel, starting from early childhood and projecting yourself into the future, sliding to and fro effortlessly. This Proustian virtuosity is unique to humans. 3. Embodiment. You feel anchored and at home in your body. It never occurs to you that the hand you just used to pick up your car keys might not belong to you. Nor would you think you're in any danger of believing the arm of a waiter or a cashier is in fact your own arm. However, scratch the surface, and it turns out your sense of embodiment is surprisingly fallible and flexible. Believe it or not, you can be optically tricked into temporarily leaving your body and experiencing yourself in another location. This happens to some extent when you view a live, real-time video of yourself or stand in a carnival hall of mirrors. By wearing heavy makeup to disguise yourself and looking at your own video image, which doesn't have to do a left-right reversal like a mirror, you can get an inkling of an out-of-body experience, especially if you move various body parts and change your expression. Furthermore, as we saw in Chapter 1, your body image is highly malleable. It can be altered in position and size using mirrors. And as we will see later in this chapter, it can be profoundly disturbed in disease. 4. Privacy. Your qualia and mental life are your own, unobservable by others. You can empathize with your neighbor's pain thanks to mirror neurons, but you can't literally experience his pain. Yet, as we noted in Chapter 4, There are circumstances under which your brain generates touch sensations that precisely simulate the sensations being experienced by another individual. For instance, if I anesthetize your arm and have you watch me touch my own arm, you begin to feel my touch sensations. So much for the privacy of self. 5. Social embedding. The self maintains an arrogant sense of privacy and autonomy that belies how closely it is linked to other brains. Can it be coincidental that almost all of our emotions make sense only in relation to other people? Pride, arrogance, vanity, ambition, love, fear, mercy, jealousy, anger, hubris, humility, pity, even self-pity, none of these would have any meaning in a social vacuum. It makes perfect evolutionary sense to feel grudges, gratitude, or bonhomie, for example, toward other people based on your shared interpersonal histories. You take intent into account and attribute the faculty of choice or free will to fellow social beings and apply your rich palette of social emotions to their actions on that basis. But we are so deeply hardwired for imputing things such as motive, intent, and culpability to the actions of others that we often overextend our social emotions to non-human, non-social objects or situations. You can get angry with the tree branch that fell on you, or even with the freeways or the stock market. It is worth noting that this is one of the major roots of religion. We tend to imbue nature itself with human-like motives, desire, and will, and hence we feel compelled to supplicate, pray to, bargain with, and look for reasons why God or karma or what have you has seen fit to punish us, individually or collectively, with natural disasters or other hardships. This persistent drive reveals just how much the self needs to feel part of a social environment that it can interact with and understand on its own terms. 6. Free will. You have a sense of being able to consciously choose between alternative courses of action with the full knowledge that you could have chosen otherwise. You normally don't feel like an automaton or as though your mind is a passive thing buffeted by chance and circumstance, although in some diseases, such as romantic love, you come close. We don't yet know how free will works, but as we shall see later in the chapter, at least two brain regions are crucially involved. The first is the supramarginal gyrus on the left side of the brain, which allows you to conjure up and envisage different potential courses of action. The second is the anterior cingulate, which makes you desire and helps you choose one action based on a hierarchy of values dictated by the prefrontal cortex. 7. Self-awareness. This aspect of the self is almost axiomatic. A self that is not aware of itself is an oxymoron. Later in this chapter, I will argue that your self-awareness might partly depend on your brain using mirror neurons recursively, allowing you to see yourself from another person's allocentric viewpoint. Hence, the use of terms like self-conscious, embarrassed, when what you really mean is being conscious of someone else being conscious of you. These 7 aspects, like the legs of a table, work together to hold up what we call the self. However, as you can already see, they are vulnerable to illusions, delusions, and disorders. The table of the self can continue to stand without one of these legs, but if too many are lost, then its stability becomes severely compromised. How did these multiple attributes of self emerge in evolution? What parts of the brain are involved, and what are the underlying neural mechanisms? There are no simple answers to these questions, certainly nothing to rival the simplicity of a statement like, "because that is how God made us," but just because the answers are complicated and counterintuitive is no reason to give up the quest. By exploring several syndromes that straddle the boundary between psychiatry and neurology, I believe we can glean invaluable clues to how the self is created and sustained in normal brains. In this regard, My approach is similar to that used elsewhere in the book, considering odd cases to illuminate normal function. I do not claim to have solved the problem of self, I wish, but I believe these cases provide very promising ways it can be approached. Overall, I think this is not a bad start for tackling a problem that is not even considered legitimate by many scientists. Several points are worth noting before we examine particular cases. One is that despite the bizarreness of symptoms, each patient is relatively normal in other respects. A second is that each patient is completely sincere and confident in his belief, and this belief is immune from intellectual correction, just like persistent superstitions in otherwise rational people. A patient with panic attacks might agree with you intellectually that his forebodings of doom are not real, but during the attack itself, nothing will convince him that he isn't dying. One last caveat. We need to be careful when drawing insights from psychiatric syndromes because some of them, none I hope that I am examining here, are bogus. Take, for example, de Clerambault syndrome, which is defined as a young woman developing an obsessive delusion that a much older and famous man is madly in love with her, but he is in denial about it. Google it, if you don't believe me. Ironically, there's no name for the very real and common delusion in which an older gentleman believes that a young hottie is in love with him but doesn't know it. One reason for this might be that the psychiatrists who discover and name syndromes have historically been men. Then there is Koro, the alleged disorder said to afflict Asian gentlemen who claim that their penis is shrinking and will eventually wither away. Again, the converse does exist in some elderly Caucasian men, the delusion that the penis is expanding, when it actually isn't. This was pointed out to me by my colleague Stuart Anstis. Koro is likely to have been fabricated by Western psychiatrists, though it is not inconceivable that it might arise from a reduced representation of the penis in the body image center, the right superior parietal lobule. And let's not forget another notable invention, oppositional defiant disorder. This diagnosis is sometimes given to smart, spirited youngsters who dare to question the authority of older establishment figures, such as psychiatrists. Believe it or not, this is a diagnosis for which a psychologist can actually bill the patient's insurance company. The person who concocted this syndrome, whoever he or she is brilliant, for any attempt by the patient to challenge or protest the diagnosis can itself be construed as evidence for its validity. Irrefutability is built into its very definition. Another pseudo-malady, again officially recognized, is chronic underachievement syndrome, what used to be called stupidity. With these caveats in mind, let us try to tackle the syndromes themselves and explore their relevance to the self and to human uniqueness. Embodiment. We will begin with three disorders that allow us to examine the mechanisms involved in creating a sense of embodiment. These conditions reveal that the brain has an innate body image, and when that body image doesn't match up with the sensory input from the body, whether visual or somatic, the ensuing disharmony can disrupt the self's sense of unity as well. Apotemnophilia. Doctor, remove my arm, please. Vital to the human sense of self is a person's feeling of inhabiting his own body and owning his body parts. Although a cat has an implicit body image of sorts, it doesn't try to squeeze into a rat hole, it can't go on a diet, seeing that it is obese, or contemplate its paw and wish it weren't there. Yet the latter is precisely what happens in some patients who develop apotemnophilia, a curious disorder in which a completely normal individual has an intense and ever-present desire to amputate an arm or a leg. Apotemnophilia derives from the Greek apo, away from, temnine, to cut, and philia, emotional attachment to. He may describe his body as being overcomplete or his arm as being intrusive. You get the feeling that the subject is trying to convey something ineffable. For instance, he might say, "It's not as if I feel it doesn't belong to me, doctor. On the contrary, it feels like it's too present." More than half the patients go on to actually have the limb removed. Apotemnophilia is often viewed as being psychological. It has even been suggested that it arises from a Freudian wish fulfillment fantasy, the stump resembling a large penis. Others have regarded the condition as attention-seeking behavior, although why the desire for attention should take this strange form, and why so many of these people keep their desires secret for much of their lives, is never explained. Frankly, I find these psychological explanations unconvincing. The condition usually begins early in life, and it is unlikely that a 10-year-old would desire a giant penis, although an orthodox Freudian wouldn't rule it out. Moreover, the subject can point to the specific line, say 2 centimeters above the elbow, along which she desires amputation. It isn't simply a vague desire to eliminate a limb, as one would expect from a pseudo-dynamic account, nor would it be a desire to attract attention, for if that were the case, why be so particular about where the cut should be made? Finally, the subject usually has no other psychological issues of any consequence. There are also 2 other observations I made of these patients that strongly suggest a neurological origin for the condition. First, in more than 2/3 of cases, the left limb is involved. This disproportionate involvement of the left arm reminds me of the decidedly neurological disorder of somatoparaphrenia, described later, in which the patient, who has a right hemisphere stroke, not only denies the paralysis of his left arm, but also insists that the arm doesn't belong to him. This is rarely seen in those with left hemisphere strokes. Second, my students Paul McGuch and David Brang and I have found that touching the limb below the line of the desired amputation produces a big jolt in the patient's GSR, galvanic skin response, but touching above the line or touching the other limb does not. The patient's alarm bells really and truly go off when the affected limb is touched below the line. Since it's hard to fake a GSR, we can be fairly sure of a neurological basis for the disorder. How does one explain this strange disorder in terms of the known anatomy? As we saw in Chapter 1, nerves for touch, muscle, tendon, and joint sensation project to your primary, S1, and secondary, S2, somatosensory cortices in and just behind the postcentral gyrus. Each of these areas of the cortex contains a systematic, topographically organized map of bodily sensations. From there, somatosensory information gets sent to your superior parietal lobule, SPL, where it gets combined with balance information from your inner ear and visual feedback about the limb's positions. Together, these inputs construct your body image, a unified, real-time representation of your physical self. This representation of the body in the SPL, and probably its connections with the posterior insula, is partly innate. We know this because some patients with arms missing from birth experienced vivid phantom arms, implying the existence of scaffolding that is hardwired by genes. It doesn't require a leap of faith to suggest that this multisensory body image is organized topographically in the SPL the same way it is in S1 and S2. If a particular body part, such as an arm or a leg, failed to be represented in this hardwired scaffolding of your body image, the result could conceivably be a sense of strangeness or possibly revulsion toward it. But why? Why is the patient not merely indifferent to the limb? After all, patients with nerve damage to the arm resulting in a complete loss of sensation don't say they want their arm removed. The answer to this question lies in the key concept of mismatch aversion, which, as you will see, plays a crucial role in many forms of mental illness. The general idea is that lack of coherence, or mismatch, between outputs of brain modules can create alienation, discomfort, delusion, or paranoia. The brain abhors internal anomalies, such as the mismatch between emotion and identification in Capgras syndrome, and will often go to absurd lengths to deny them or explain them away. I emphasize internal because, generally speaking, the brain is more tolerant of anomalies in the external world. It may even enjoy them. Some people love the thrill of solving baffling mysteries. It isn't clear where the internal mismatch is detected to create unpleasantness. I suggest it's done by the insula, especially the insula in the right hemisphere, a small patch of tissue which receives signals from S2 and sends outputs to the amygdala, which in turn sends sympathetic arousal signals down to the rest of the body. In the case of nerve damage, the input to S1 and S2 itself is lost, so there is no mismatch or discrepancy between S2 and the multisensory body image in the SPL. In apotemnophilia, by contrast, there is normal sensory input from the limb to the body maps in S1 and S2, but there is no place for the limb signals to output to in the SPL body image maintained by the SPL. The brain does not tolerate this mismatch well, and so this discrepancy is crucial for creating the feelings of overpresence and mild aversiveness to the limb, and the accompanying desire for amputation. This explanation of apotemnophilia would account for the heightened GSR and also the essentially ineffable and paradoxical nature of the experience, part of the body and not part of the body at the same time. Consistent with this overall framework, I have noticed that merely having the patient look at his affected limb through a minifying lens to optically shrink it makes the limb feel far less unpleasant, presumably by reducing the mismatch. Placebo-controlled experiments are needed to confirm this. Finally, my lab conducted a brain scanning study on 4 patients with apotemnophilia and compared the results with 4 normal control subjects. In the controls, touching any part of the body activated right SPL. In all 4 patients, touching the part of the limb each one wanted removed evoked no activity in the SPL. The brain's map of the body didn't light up, so to speak, on the scans. But touching the unaffected limb did. If we can replicate this finding with a larger number of patients, our theory will be well supported. One curious aspect of apotemnophilia that is unexplained by our model is the associated sexual inclinations in some subjects, desire for intimacy with another amputee. These sexual overtones are probably what misled people to propose a Freudian view of the disorder. Let me suggest something different. Perhaps one's sexual aesthetic preference for certain body morphology is dictated in part by the shape of the body image as represented and hardwired in the right SPL and possibly insular cortex. This would explain why ostriches prefer ostriches as mates, presumably even when smell cues are eliminated, and why pigs prefer porcine shapes over humans. Expanding on this, I suggest that there is a genetically specified mechanism that allows a template of one's body image in the SPL to become transcribed into limbic circuitry, thereby determining aesthetic visual preference. If this idea is right, then someone whose body image was congenitally armless or legless would be attracted to people missing the same limb. Consistent with this view, people who wish to have their leg amputated are almost always attracted to leg amputees, not arm amputees. Somatoparaphrenia. Doctor, this is my mother's arm. Distortion of body part ownership also occurs in one of the strangest syndromes in neurology, which has the tongue-twisting name somatoparaphrenia. Patients with left hemisphere stroke have damage to the band of fibers issuing from the cortex down to the spinal cord. Because the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body, and vice versa, this leaves the right side of their bodies paralyzed. They complain about their paralysis, asking the doctor whether the arm will ever recover, and not surprisingly, they are often depressed. When the stroke is in the right hemisphere, The paralysis is on the left. The majority of such patients are troubled by the paralysis, as expected, but a small minority deny the paralysis, anosognosia, and an even smaller subset actually deny ownership of the left arm, ascribing it to the examining physician or to a spouse, sibling, or parent. Why a particular person is chosen isn't clear, but it reminds me of the manner in which the Capgras delusion often also involves a specific individual. In this subset of patients, there is usually damage to the body maps in S1 and S2. In addition to this, the stroke has destroyed the corresponding body image representation in the right SPL, which would ordinarily receive input from S1 and S2. Sometimes there is also additional damage to the right insula, which receives input directly from S2 and also contributes to the construction of the person's body image. The net result of this combination of lesions, S1, S2, SPL, and insula, is a complete sense of disownership of the arm. The ensuing tendency to ascribe it to someone else may be a desperate, unconscious attempt to explain the alienation of the arm. Shades of Freudian projection here. Why is somatoparaphrenia only seen when the right parietal is damaged and not when the left one is? To understand this, we have to invoke the idea of division of labor between the two hemispheres, hemispheric specialization, a topic I will consider in some detail later in this chapter. Rudiments of such specialization probably exist even in the great apes, but in humans it is much more pronounced and may be yet another factor contributing to our uniqueness. Transsexuality. Doctor, I'm trapped in the wrong kind of body. The self also has a sex. You think of yourself as male or female and expect others to treat you as such. It is such an ingrained aspect of your self-identity that you hardly ever pause to think about it, until things go awry, at least by the standards of a conservative, conformist society. The result is the disorder called transsexuality. As with somatoparaphrenia, distortions or mismatches in the SPL can also explain the symptoms of transsexuals. Many male-to-female transsexuals report feeling that their penis seems to be redundant, or again, over-present and intrusive. Many female-to-male transsexuals report feeling like a man in a woman's body, and a majority of them have had a phantom penis since early childhood. Many of these women also report having phantom erections. In both kinds of transsexuals, the discrepancy between internally specified sexual body image, which surprisingly includes details of sexual anatomy, and external anatomy leads to an intense discomfort and, again, a yearning to reduce the mismatch. Scientists have shown that during fetal development, different aspects of sexuality are set in motion in parallel. Sexual morphology, external anatomy, sexual identity, what you see yourself as, sexual orientation, what sex you are attracted to, and sexual body image, your brain's internal representation of your body parts. Normally, these harmonize during physical and social development to culminate in normal sexuality, but they can become uncoupled, leading to deviations that shift the individual toward one or the other end of the spectrum of normal distribution. I am using the words normal and deviation here only in the statistical sense relative to the overall human population. I do not mean to imply that these ways of being are undesirable or perverse. Many transsexuals have told me that they would rather have surgery than be cured of their desire. If this seems strange, think of intense but unrequited romantic love. Would you request that your desire be removed? There is no simple answer. Privacy. In Chapter 4, I explained the role of the mirror neuron system in viewing the world from another person's point of view, both spatially and perhaps metaphorically. In humans, this system may have turned inward, enabling a representation of one's own mind. With the mirror neuron system thus bent back on itself full circle, self-awareness was born. There is a subsidiary evolutionary question of which came first, other awareness or self-awareness, but that's tangential. My point is that the two co-evolved, enriching each other enormously and culminating in the kind of reciprocity between self-awareness and other awareness seen only in humans. Although mirror neurons allow you to tentatively adopt another person's vantage point, they don't result in an out-of-body experience. You don't literally float out to where that other vantage point is, nor do you lose your identity as a person. Similarly, when you watch another person being touched, your touch neurons fire, but even though you empathize, you don't actually feel the touch. It turns out that in both cases, your frontal lobes inhibit the activated mirror neurons at least enough to stop all this from happening, so you remain anchored in your own body. Additionally, touch neurons in your skin send a null signal to your mirror neurons saying, "Hey, you are not being touched," to ensure that you don't literally feel the other guy being touched. Thus, in the normal brain, a dynamic interplay of three sets of signals, mirror neurons, frontal lobes, and sensory receptors, is responsible for preserving both the individuality of your own mind and body and your mind's reciprocity with others, a paradoxical state of affairs unique to humans. Disturbances in this system, we shall see, would lead to a dissolution of interpersonal boundaries, personal identity, and body image, allowing us to explain a wide spectrum of seemingly incomprehensible symptoms seen in psychiatry. For example, derangements in frontal inhibition of the mirror neuron system may lead to a disturbing out-of-body experience, as though you were really watching yourself from above. Such syndromes reveal how blurred the boundary between reality and illusion can become under certain circumstances. Mirror neurons and exotic syndromes. Mirror neuron activity can go awry in many ways, sometimes in full-blown neurological disorders, but also, I suspect, in numerous more subtle ways as well. For instance, I wonder whether a dissolution of interpersonal boundaries may also explain more exotic syndromes such as folie à deux, in which two people, such as Bush and Cheney, share each other's madness. Romantic love is a minor form of folie à deux, a mutual delusional fantasy that often afflicts otherwise normal people. Another example is Munchausen syndrome by proxy, in which hypochondriasis, where every trifling symptom is experienced as a harbinger of fatal illness, is unconsciously projected onto another, the proxy, often by a parent onto his or her child, instead of onto oneself. Much more bizarre is the Couvade syndrome, in which men in Lamaze classes start developing pseudocyesis, or false signs of pregnancy. Perhaps mirror neuron activity results in the release of empathy hormones, such as prolactin, which act on the brain and body to generate a phantom pregnancy. Even Freudian phenomena, such as projection, begin to make sense. You wish to deny your unpleasant emotions, but they are too salient to deny completely, so you ascribe them to others. It's the I-you confusion again. As we will see, this is not unlike a patient with somatoparaphrenia projecting her paralyzed arm to her mother. Lastly, there is Freudian countertransference, in which the psychoanalyst's self starts fusing with the patient's, which can sometimes land the psychoanalyst in legal trouble if the patient is of the opposite sex. Obviously, I am not claiming to have explained these syndromes. I am merely pointing out how they might fit into our overall scheme and how they may give us hints about the manner in which the normal brain constructs a sense of self. Autism. In Chapter 5, I presented evidence that a paucity of mirror neurons, or the circuits they project to, may underlie autism. If mirror neurons do indeed play a role in self-representation, then one would predict that an autistic person, even a high-functioning one, could probably not introspect, could never feel self-esteem or self-deprecation, let alone experience self-pity or self-aggrandizement, or even know what these words mean. Nor could the child experience the embarrassment and the blush that accompanies the state of being self-conscious. Casual observations of autistic people suggest that all this might be true, but there have been no systematic experiments to determine the limits of their introspective abilities. For example, if I were to ask you what's the difference between need and desire, you need toothpaste, you desire a woman or man, or between pride and arrogance, hubris and humility, or sadness and sorrow, you would typically think for a bit before being able to spell out the distinction. An autistic child may be incapable of these distinctions while still being capable of other abstract distinctions, such as, what's the difference between a Democrat and a Republican other than IQ? Another subtle test might be to see whether a high-functioning autistic child or adult can understand a conspiratorial wink, which usually involves a three-way social interaction between you, the person you are winking at, and a third person, real or imaginary, in the vicinity. This requires representing one's own as well as the other two people's minds. If I give you a sly wink when telling a lie to someone else who can't see the wink, then I have an implied social contract with you. I am letting you in on this. See how I am tricking that person? A wink is also used when flirting with someone, unbeknownst to others in the vicinity, although I don't know if this is universal to all cultures. And lastly, you wink to someone to whom you are saying something in jest, as if to say, "You realize I'm only joking, right?" I once asked the famous high-functioning autist and writer Temple Grandin whether she knew what winking meant. She told me that she understands winking intellectually, but doesn't ever do it, and has no intuitive feel for it. More directly relevant to the framework of the present chapter is the observation made by Leo Kanner, who first described autism, that autistic children often confuse the pronouns me and you in conversation. This shows a poor differentiation of ego boundaries and a failure of the self-other distinction, which, as we have seen, depends partially on mirror neurons and associated frontal inhibitory circuitry. The frontal lobes and the insula. Earlier in this chapter, I suggested that apotemnophilia results from a mismatch between somatosensory cortices S1 and S2, on the one hand, and on the other, the superior and inferior parietal lobules, the region where you normally construct a dynamic image of your body in space. But where exactly is the mismatch detected? Probably in the insula, which is buried in the temporal lobes. The posterior, back half of this structure combines multiple sensory inputs, including pain, from internal organs, muscles, joints, and vestibular sense of balance organs in the ear to generate an unconscious sense of embodiment. Discrepancies between different inputs here produce vaguely articulated discomfort, as when your vestibular and visual senses are put in conflict on a ship and you feel queasy. The posterior insula then relays to the front, anterior part of the insula. The eminent neuroanatomist Arthur D. Bud Craig from the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix has suggested that the posterior insula registers only rudimentary unconscious sensations, which need to be re-represented in more sophisticated form in the anterior insula before your body image can be consciously experienced. Craig's re-representations are loosely similar to what I called meta-representations in Phantoms in the Brain. But in my scheme, further back-and-forth interactions with the anterior cingulate and other frontal structures are required for constructing your full sense of being a person reflecting on your sensations and making choices. Without these interactions, it makes little sense to speak of a conscious self, whether embodied or not. So far in this book, I have said very little about the frontal lobes, which became especially well-developed in hominins and must play an important role in our uniqueness. Technically, the frontal lobes are comprised of the motor cortex as well as the bulk of the cortex in front of it, the prefrontal cortex. Each prefrontal lobe has three subdivisions, the ventromedial prefrontal, VMF, or bottom inner part, the dorsolateral, DLF, or upper outer part, and the dorsomedial, DMF, or upper inner part. See figure introduction 2. Because the colloquial term frontal lobes includes the prefrontal cortex as well, I use F in these abbreviations, not P. Let's consider some of the functions of these three prefrontal regions. I invoked the VMF in Chapter 8 when discussing pleasurable aesthetic responses to beauty. The VMF also receives signals from the anterior insula to generate your conscious sense of being embodied. In conjunction with parts of the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, it motivates desire to take action. For instance, the discrepancy in body image in apotemnophilia, picked up in the right anterior insula, would be relayed to the VMF and the anterior cingulate to motivate a conscious plan of action. Go to Mexico and get the arm removed. In parallel, the insula projects directly to the amygdala, which activates the autonomic fight-or-flight response via the hypothalamus. That would explain the heightened skin sweating, galvanic skin response, or GSR, that we saw in our patients with apotemnophilia. Of course, all this is pure speculation. At this point, we don't even know whether my explanation of apotemnophilia is correct. Nonetheless, my hypothesis illustrates the style of reasoning needed to explain many brain disorders. Just brushing such disorders aside as being mental or psychological problems serves no purpose. Such labeling neither illuminates normal function nor helps the patient. Given their extensive connections with limbic structures, it is hardly surprising that the medial frontal lobes, the VMF, and possibly the DMF, are also involved in setting up the hierarchy of values that govern your ethics and morality, traits that are especially well-developed in humans. Unless you are a sociopath who has disturbances in these circuits, as shown by Antonio Damasio, you don't usually lie or cheat, even when 100% sure you could get away with it if you tried. Indeed, your sense of morality and your concern for what others think of you are so powerful that you even act to extend them beyond your death. Imagine you have been diagnosed with terminal cancer and have old letters in your drawers that could be dredged up after your death, incriminating you in a sex scandal. If you are like most people, you will promptly destroy the evidence, even though, logically, why should your posthumous reputation matter to you once you are gone? I have already hinted at the role of mirror neurons in empathy. Apes almost certainly have empathy of sorts, but humans have both empathy and free will, the two necessary ingredients for moral choice. This trait requires a more sophisticated deployment of mirror neurons, acting in conjunction with the anterior cingulate, than any ape before us has achieved. Let's turn now to the dorsomedial prefrontal area, DMF. The DMF has been found in brain imaging studies to be involved in conceptual aspects of the self. If you are asked to describe your own attributes and personality traits rather than someone else's, this area lights up in brain imaging studies. On the other hand, if you were to describe the raw feel of your embodiment, one would expect your VMF to light up, but this hasn't been tested yet. Lastly, there is the dorsolateral prefrontal area. The DLF is required for holding things in your current, ongoing mental landscape, so you can use your ACC to direct attention to different aspects of the information and act according to your desires. The technical name for this function is working memory. The DLF is also required for logical reasoning, which involves paying attention to different facets of a problem and juggling abstractions, such as words and numbers, synthesized in the inferior parietal lobules. See Chapter 4. How and where the precise rules for this juggling arise is anybody's guess. The DLF also interacts with the parietal lobe. The two act jointly to construct a consciously experienced animated body moving in space and time, which complements the insula VMF pathway's creation of a more viscerally felt anchoring of yourself in your body. The subjective boundary between these two types of body image is somewhat blurred, reminding us of the sheer complexity of connections needed for even something as simple as your body image. This point will be driven home later. We will encounter a patient with a phantom twin next to him. Vestibular stimulation caused the twin to shrink and move. This implies powerful interactions between A, vestibular input to the insula, which produces a visceral anchoring of the body, and B, vestibular input to the right parietal lobe, which, along with muscle, joint sense, and vision, constructs a vivid sense of a consciously experienced moving body.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Unity. What if the self is not produced by a single entity, but by the push and pull of multiple forces of which we are largely unconscious? Now I'll use the lenses of anosognosia and out-of-body experiences to examine the unity and disunity of the self. Hemispheric specialization. Doctor, I am in two minds. A great deal of pop psychology deals with the question of how the two hemispheres might be specialized for different roles. For example, the right hemisphere is thought to be more intuitive, creative, and emotional than the left, which is said to be more linear, rational, and Spock-like in its mentality. Many a New Age guru has used the idea to promote ways of unleashing the hidden potential of the right hemisphere. As with most pop ideas, there is a kernel of truth to all this. In Phantoms in the Brain, I postulated that the two hemispheres have different but complementary coping styles in dealing with the world. Here I will consider the relevance of this to understanding anosognosia, the denial of paralysis seen in some stroke patients. Speaking more generally, it can help us understand why even most normal people, including you and me, engage in minor denials and rationalizations to cope with the stresses of our daily lives. What is the evolutionary function of these hemispheric differences, if any? Information arriving through the senses is ordinarily merged with pre-existing memories to create a belief system about yourself and the world. This internally consistent belief system, I suggest, is constructed mainly by the left hemisphere. If there is a small piece of anomalous information that doesn't fit your big-picture belief system, the left hemisphere tries to smooth over the discrepancies and anomalies in order to preserve the coherence of self and the stability of behavior. In a process called confabulation, the left hemisphere sometimes even fabricates information to preserve its harmony and overall view of itself. A Freudian might say that the left hemisphere does this to avoid shattering the ego, or to reduce what psychologists refer to as cognitive dissonance, a disharmony between different internal aspects of self. Such disconnects give rise to the confabulations, denials, and delusions that one sees in psychiatry. In other words, Freudian defenses originate mainly in the left hemisphere. In my account, however, unlike in orthodox Freudianism, they evolved not to protect the ego, but to stabilize behavior and impose a sense of coherence and narrative to your life. But there has to be a limit. If left unchecked, the left hemisphere would likely render a person delusional or manic. It is one thing to play down some of your weaknesses to yourself. An unrealistic optimism may be useful temporarily for forging ahead, but another thing to delude yourself into thinking you are rich enough to buy a Ferrari, or that your arm is not paralyzed, when neither is true. So it seems reasonable to postulate a devil's advocate in the right hemisphere that allows you to adopt a detached, objective, allocentric view of yourself. This right brain system would often be able to detect major discrepancies that your egocentric,